The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
That if there is a system in which Christ is not a vicarious substitutionary sacrifice for sin, then inevitably, however much language of grace you use, you are in a system of merit. And that, I think, is the point that Paul hones in on as a result of his own conversion and coming to an experience and knowledge of grace as it is in Christ. That's what Paul understands about Judaism and opposes in Judaism. That without Christ, let me say that again, and without the atoning provision that there is in Christ, no matter how much the language of grace may be functioning, you are involved in a religion of merit, in securing a God's approval by what you do. So, what Paul is opposed to in the works of the law is any and all human effort. And by the way, that would include faith. What Paul is opposing is any and all human effort relied upon for justification. Any human endeavor included faith, including faith as a basis for justification. So that from this perspective, just to connect back to, I haven't forgotten about your break, by the way. Finish off this thought. Good works, and as good works would be defined by obedience to the law, they cease to be that. They cease to be good works and become its opposite, however you might want to define that. They become reprehensible works if they are done to earn God's favor, to maintain or secure from Him the forgiveness of sins. Maybe I could make the additional comment here that Paul's polemic then against the law is against a misuse of the law. It's not only against a misuse. He is concerned to indicate what the law of itself does. It condemns. But it does certainly include, his polemic does include a misuse. All right, let's break here. We can pick up questions or move on. Oh, by the way, I will have your assignments on the Romans the pericope presentations next week for sure. I think that still gives you a good time. Okay. Anybody? I was sort of elaborating my notes on the spot here, and that's sort of a guarantee that I will be less clear than normal. Anybody want to pick up at all in the comments about the law here before we move on? Yes?
If it's true that Paul Polemic is just against the misuse of the law, it would seem then that the conclusion would be, simple reform type of notion, that then the law would be fine in the context of Christ that we keep the law sort of a pretty far. And yet, I'm wondering how you deal with the fact that Paul clearly changes the law. That's what gets appealing about Dunn, you know, is that circumcision is definitely out now. The food laws are definitely out. All the border things do seem to be gone now. And I'm wondering if Paul has a new, an eschatological view of the law now, that in light of Christ it really means this.
Yeah, well, we're focused on the law for justification. And, see, I would say it's not just against the misuse. I'm saying what I said right at the end, it is against the misuse. That is, the opponents in Galatians were doing something with the law. But it wasn't that that they were misusing the law that could otherwise be used for justification. Paul is polemicizing against any use of the law for justification. Now, how the law functions then afterward in the life of the believer, I think, is not unrelated. Obviously, it's not, because it's the obedience of faith. But it's a distinct question. So, now, I think what I hear in your question is really, I better just leave to the side for now. By the way, the book by Frank Thielman, I think, is of the things that I've looked at. I forget if he has one or two ends on. I think he really interacts very effectively with Dunn. And anyone in the discussion, even say the classical Protestant position, makes a distinction between ceremonial, civil, and moral, in which, you know, the food laws go. I'm not sure that we want to eliminate eliminate circumcision in the sense of losing its positive link with baptism, which Dunn has no concern for, and I won't say anything about the Sabbath.
You made the statement that if Christ is not substituting your sacrifice, your own system, no matter what you say about grace and assistance and merit. I think I know what you say, but I'd like to hear you say it. Does Paul think the Old Covenant is a system of merit? In other words, is the problem that the Jews misunderstood the Old Covenant, or was the Old Covenant itself a system of merit?
As you say, you probably anticipate. I wouldn't be decisive in arguing. We were just having a discussion in the break. You see, I think if we could make pre-conversion Paul, it's that personal, the target of his opposition. You got to distinguish him from the Simeons and the Annas. The Simeon and Anna, they as embodying Old Testament faith, if you will, in the tradition of Abraham, they are focused in on who Christ is, positively. Whereas the Judaism that Paul is polemicizing against is not that Judaism, but the Judaism that crucifies the Christ. So I think you do have to make that distinction that it is a misunderstanding.
So when he speaks of in 2 Corinthians 3 that the Old Covenant has glory, that it brings death and establishes them, do you think he's referring to a misunderstanding? Or is he talking about the effect of the law in the sense of the
world? No, I think he's saying that the old by itself as old condemns, it kills. That's why the law, you see, the law considered in itself is never a way to justification. Okay. What we've been saying, let's along the a different front, or to relate now to a larger question. We already, I think, in what we've been reflecting on here, have in seed form the resolution to the perennial apparent conflict between Paul and James on justification. And just to address that briefly. The answer, or the resolution of this dilemma, let me put it just this way, it almost certainly does not lie. That's a slightly waffling way of putting it, you see. the answer almost certainly does not lie in positing a different meaning for the verb, dikaioo. For Paul on the one hand, James on the other. That is, to be a little bit more forthcoming here, those who make this distinction would have it, for Paul, the verb has a forensic and declarative sense. Whereas for James, it's a so-called demonstrative sense. Rather, that, for instance, this is the... Yes, go ahead.
I'm just wondering, that would be... I know, for example, they had, you know, a commentary on James last year, which he basically says, when James is faith demonstrating itself before man, is a distinction before man and before God, this kind of...
Yeah, well, I think there's a demonstrative dimension. I wouldn't want it, but let me go on a little bit. I think maybe I'll be a little clearer. Now, I haven't read Hodges, so...
Right, the totally other side of the lordship.
Right, right. let me say a little bit more and see how it matches with what he's saying. I think we have to maintain, at the end of doing all the lexical work, that the sense is the same for both Paul and James, a forensic declarative sense. A demonstrative sense in the sense of shown to be justified, which is what you find already in Calvin's commentary, and we're having to disagree with him here, which we don't need to do. But a demonstrative sense, in the sense of shown, that's what I meant by a demonstrative sense, shown to be justified, is, I think, simply without support lexically. I guess we might say it's lexically unjustified. I think it is, on reflection, a piece of dogmatizing lexicography. If we recognize that, then the difference between a forensic declarative force, that is, between declared to be just and shown to be just, if we recognize that shown to be justified is not defensible lexically, I'm not trying to argue that, I'm just asserting that. That's something you'd have to establish to your satisfaction. If that's the case, then the difference between the forensic or declarative force and the demonstrative force virtually disappears. That is, the difference between declared to be just and shown to be just. So I don't think that we help ourselves in this passage by trying to establish a different force for the verb. Rather, I think we're on sounder ground to recognize, in recognizing that the difference lies between Paul and St. James, the difference lies in how each uses faith and works. That's where the difference lies. And here we can simply pick up on a formulation of Machen that I think has captured this so neatly. I don't know how you improve on this. This comes from the little work on, Introduction to the New... It's not Introduction to the New Testament. Something about the... Okay, Introduction to the New Testament. It's if you're an Acts and Paul, you've read it. If you have taken the Axon Paul course, excuse me. Machen puts it this way, a kind of an aphorism that I think does not oversimplify at all, but gets right at the heart of matter. Machen puts it this way, the works that Paul condemns are not the works that James commends. Condemns, commends. The works that Paul condemns, that he polemicizes against, are not the works that James commends. It's obviously approving. And what those are, basically, are self-securing works. Self-congratulatory works. At least how Paul saw them in Philippians 3. Whereas what James is talking about is what Paul refers to as good works, or what we could draw in the orbit of our own discussion, the obedience of faith. Similarly, to put it the other way now, the faith, looking at faith now, the faith that James condemns is not the faith that Paul commends. So there's the play, you see, on the other way around now. The faith that James condemns is not the faith that Paul commends. James has in view what he calls faith that is arge, James 2:20. Dead, idle, useless. Whereas, I'll pick up just a second, whereas for Paul, what Paul commends, the faith that Paul commends, as we'll see more clearly, is living faith, faith that is active, faith that is fruitful in obedience. So I think contrasting the different senses of faith and works helps here, and I'm going to go on and suggest a link then between the two in just a minute. Yeah, go ahead, pick up one.
I was just going to say, this may be a different book, so it's outside the scope of the course, but would you place a lot of weight on the fact that in James 2:14, James uses the article, there in the second occurrence of faith, can that faith save them? In other words, it seems like James is contrasting in that last section of chapter 2 different kinds of faith, the orge, the dead faith, and then a true faith that issues in works.
Yeah, well, sir, where would the faith that produces works, where would that come in?
Well, that would be the end of the chapter where it talks about
Where faith is without works is dead.
Let me remind myself here. It's I guess he's primarily focusing on faith that has no works, I guess, in James. But implicitly, I guess my question is. For example, one thing I do recall from Zane Hodges is he makes a big deal of debunking the idea that you can make a distinction between a false kind of faith, which is what James seems to be talking about in chapter 2, and true faith on the basis of the article at the end of James 2:14. Because he says that the article appears to have other occurrences of faith. And I just wondered, I think the presence of the article in 2:14 is significant, because it does, to me, underscore that James is talking about a false kind of faith as over against the true kind of faith that, say, Paul is talking about.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much weight you could put on, how far you could push that. The article would certainly make, it has a definite force. It's bringing into view he's going to talk about faith in a certain way, and that's the framework. I would say it would be more an implicit question. It would leave unanswered the question, what would he say positively about faith? Now, I think you can perhaps tease that out from James, but that's part of the problem, that James doesn't, you know, have kind of an even-handed development in the sense of going on and talking about faith in a positive sense.
So James primarily focuses just on a negative.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I'm quite content, you know, with the way that Machen, the faith that Paul commends is not the faith that James condemns. Just a little bit further here. I think a link between the two perspectives, and here I think is where, this would be a third of these additional observations on the basic conclusion we were drawing under C about the obedience of faith. I think a link that points to the essential harmony is Paul's description of faith in Galatians 5:6. What Paul says in Galatians 5:6. Particularly right at the end of verse 6. He says, in Christ Jesus, neither circumcision avails for anything, nor uncircumcision, but faith working through love. Faith working through love. Or faith active in love. NIV has faith expressing itself through love, which would, I think, be a fair rendering. Now, not simply to point to this phrase in isolation, but I think a brief examination in context is very instructive at this point. As you can see from reading verse 6, the latter part expresses the positive side of a contrast signalized by a law. What is said about faith stands in contrast, is contrasted with the essentially negative thought of the beginning of verse 6. Namely, that in Christ, and I think we should understand this almost certainly here in the sense of in union with Christ, that we might need to discuss further. In union with Christ, Paul says, neither circumcision or uncircumcision, ti iskoue, has any value. Neither of them has any value or means anything, New American Standard Bible. Now, that statement raises the question, with reference to what is circumcision or uncircumcision without value? What is the reference point of the without value? I think the answer to that question can only lie in the references to the circumcision that we have earlier in this pericope. By the way, I think we would have to recognize that we do have a unit here. You'd have to work through a discourse analysis of Galatians to establish that. But verse 6, should have said this earlier, is sort of the bottom line, the capstone statement flowing out of what is said in the immediately preceding assertions. And what Paul says, well, let's just read verses 2 through 4. Behold, I, Paul, tell you that if you are being circumcised, Christ does not profit you for anything. So here, profits nothing, is worth nothing. Make that connection. For I testify again to every man, every person, being circumcised, seeking circumcision, that you are debtor to do the whole law. For you have been cut off from Christ, whoever is seeking to be justified by the law. Give that a connotative sense. You have fallen from grace. For we by the Spirit, in the Spirit by faith, await the hope of righteousness. And then verse 6. Now, verse 4 tells us that those who receive circumcision in compliance with at the urging of the opponents, the so-called Judaizers, you can see their activity mentioned in chapter 6, verse 12, they are seeking to be justified by the law, in nomo. And so in that effort, in wanting to be justified by the law, they are, Paul says, cut off from Christ. They fall away from Christ. But in what sense do they fall away from Christ? Clearly, his point is they fall away from Christ as a source of grace, as a source, even more specifically, of justifying grace. When you attempt to be justified from the law, you're cut off from Christ as the source of the grace of justification. So it appears to me there can be little, if any, question that when we come to verse 6, what Paul is saying at the beginning is that, the beginning of the verse is this, what circumcision and uncircumcision do not avail for specifically is they do not avail for justification. They do not avail for justification. Human status means nothing for justification. But that carries with it the further observation that what does then have value, by the contrast, what does have value then for justification is faith. Faith described here as working through love. Now, I can't see how you can evade that conclusion exegetically. As if you get into some of the commentary literature, you'll see that people want to argue something of a break at verse 5, and that what Paul has in view is moved beyond what he has said about justification. I don't see how you could establish that, particularly when it's most likely that verse 5 is in fact talking about a future dimension to justification. But that's another issue that we'll say a little bit more on further. Yes?
Could you respond to the interpretation of law there as Old Covenant?
Yeah, I think that would be the case because the law that is in view, for almost with very few exceptions, when Paul uses nomos, he's referring specifically to the Mosaic, the law given as Sinai. So the law always stands for the office of Moses, if you will. So I'm not quite sure. I mean, it's still the law. It's the law, say, focused in its heart in the Decalogue. Yes?
Is there a further connection, Paul, here, since he says faith does and circumcision does in terms of justifying, but then does he go on to say that faith also completes the whole law? There's an interesting connection there between
obligated to the whole law, and then in 5:14 he says the whole law is summed up in love. He's trying to make a further point about that in fact we do keep the whole law whereas you can't.
Yeah, I think that I think that does raise the question. Let me just leave it here. I think, to really answer that satisfactorily, we'd have to get into the details of that passage. I think he is assigning the law a positive role. That's the very least you would want to say there in chapter 5. It does, what you're, later on in the chapter, what you're raising, though, here is, what you're touching on by your question is why does he express it as he does here? And I think it may be because he wants to head off what he does, I guess what he's already said, and then what he will say later, a misuse of the Christian freedom. Yeah. So I think that's there, but there, it could also maybe be pointing in the direction you suggest. Now, I do... need to say some more here, haven't arrived at the conclusion that we have, that Paul says that what does have value for justification is faith working through love. Here again, we're at a state of affairs where we often come in our theologizing where the line between truth and error is a razor's edge. And especially, it would be naive of us not to be aware and to remind ourselves in our own context or in a broader context of our interpretation that this verse has been used especially by Roman Catholic theology to establish its distinction between unformed and formed faith. Formed and unformed faith. That distinction that underlies its system of justification, which is a system of justification, I believe, that falls under the ban of Paul's opposition to justification by works, in fact. The notion of what justifies for Rome is fides caritate formata. Faith formed by love. Let me just say a little bit further, just detail a little bit further how Roman Catholic soteriology elaborates this. This plays as part of a distinction that is made by Rome between first justification and second justification. First justification is the remission that is received by all at baptism. Basically, it's the removal of the consequences of original sin. Second justification, though, is an ongoing process in the life of the baptized. A process that involves condign merit. That is secured through the faithful use of the sacramental system. And what we have to be concerned, be alert to here, is that this whole construal then falsifies faith. It falsifies faith, and you can turn, if nothing else, to Calvin's commentary on this statement, Galatians 5:6, and see how he excoriates the notion of trying to read the distinction between an unformed and a formed faith into this passage. In the commentary on Galatians, and also in... I was reading it just recently, some of us in another context in historical theology, and his antidote to the Council of Trent, he addresses particularly this passage again. So we have, what I'm saying is, I'm just alerting us here to the fact that we have to be on guard against the abuse of this verse, as it has had a fateful and monumental consequences in church history. But the abuse of the verse, no matter how serious, that must not blind us to what Paul, maybe I could put it this way, what Paul is free to say here, and what we ought to recognize ourselves to be free to say, what we ought to say. And that is to describe justifying faith as working faith, loving faith, obedient faith, which, as it appears to me, is what Paul does here. Now, having said that, and again, primarily with a view toward the Roman Catholic front, it's not that the working that Paul has in view here, it's not that the working, the loving, in any way merits or otherwise provides the ground for justification, the basis for our justification. Nor is it even that the working and loving is somehow the instrument by which we receive justification. That is the sole office, if you will, of faith, and Paul makes that clear, if he makes anything clear. But what Paul's expression here does here, and what he is concerned to do, is to point up what is the essential character of the faith which alone justifies. What is indispensable to that faith that justifies. What Paul is concerned here is to highlight the disposition, if you will, the inevitable tendency of the faith that alone justifies. And that is that it is a working faith. And surely then we have to go on to say here that for the apostle, apart from that faith, apart from faith qualified as he does here, as working through love, apart from that faith, there is no justification. So I'm wanting to suggest, after what might appear to be a kind of a wide-ranging circling about here, it is to these considerations, focused as we have them here, for instance, in Galatians 5:6, it is to these considerations that Paul points when already at the beginning of Romans and at the end, he summarizes the entire object of his gospel ministry. He summarizes that as the obedience of faith. Now, if we ask the question, why does Paul qualify justifying faith as he does in Galatians 5:6? A question Adam had been raising in effect. That's an interesting question exegetically, and I just say here what I already said in reply. Perhaps what's at work here is, or what he has in view is his reference to freedom in Christ that he's already made at the end of chapter 4. And he expresses himself in a way that will cut off the abuse of that freedom to seeing the freedom as license or indulgence of sin that he addresses again in 5:13. So just to summarize, in terms of the exegetical issue that we raised at the beginning as to the force of the genitive, and my pressing us, urging us to consider that both aspects are there, the appositional and the source. Even if we were to opt, I think we could say this finally, even if we were to insist on an appositional force, while the accent would be different, it would be a more explicit accent on faith, in its distinguishing character, all that we have said about obedience would still be implicitly true, as well as what we have pointing out as to the nature of justifying faith, in the light of what Paul teaches elsewhere, in the light of what we've been seeing here, particularly at Galatians 5:6. But again, I think it's best to see a deliberate duality there in the expression. Backing up quickly to our comments on Galatians 5:6, I think what we have been emphasizing is quite consonant with the way in which the Westminster Confession of Faith in chapter 11, section 1, describes justifying faith in its formulation. That it picks up from earlier generations at that time, that the faith which alone justifies is never alone. The faith which alone justifies is never alone. And that's the point that's being made here emphatically, I think, in Galatians 5:6. Any questions, comments, before we move on here? Chapter 11, section 1. Yes?
You're going after another
item. Yes, right.
May I take you back just a moment?
By all means.
When you're contrasting or exploring the contrast, let's say, between Paul or James, am I right that you were making the point that it is not the sense of Pikaio that is differing, but it is that of faith and works?
Yes.
What did you say the sense is that is the same between Paul and James?
I think it's a declarative force. I think, or if I could be a little bit more forthcoming, I think what James is saying in the cases of Abraham and Rahab is that they have that their justification has been revalidated or vindicated. And in that sense, it has a demonstrative character to it. But I think to say lexically that it doesn't mean declared to be just, it does not mean to declare just, but it means to show to be justified, that I think is not sustainable. And I would say it has a similar declarative force in that the Lord constantly is revalidating the justifying verdict that he has pronounced once for all in the faith of believers working through love. And the ultimate vindication, the ultimate revalidation, if you will, is going to be at the judgment seat of Christ. We're going to talk about that, hold up the future dimension a little bit later on in when we get into chapter 2. But the Westminster Confession puts it, at the last judgment, believers will be openly acquitted. So I don't think we want to tone down on the forensic sense.
When to your whatever measure of uncertainty, when you say it is almost certain, it is not.
I want to be open to being corrected because it does stand against a rather established Protestant understanding of it. But you can see I feel pretty definite in my opinion. Yes.
Are you on your way back to 117?
Yeah, we're getting back to 117. Yes. Yes.
When you summarize the plowing. So you're saying that this is what Paul is saying?
Yes. I think Paul, when Paul says faith, he means a whole-souled abandonment to Christ. It's distinctive office. But when he says faith, he can never think of it without this qualification, which is the obedience of faith.
So it's not just these two bullets, two in the middle,
we can't figure out which way. No, definitely not, right? Yeah, good way of putting what I don't have in here, right? Yes. Yes.
So, functionally, as the veracity of the letter is a little bit irrelevant, it's functioning like a bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Point,
let me, bumper sticker, roll this in.
That's what you want to know is me. And you're going to do that for 15 chapters.
Yes.
But
to a large extent, yeah.
He's doing that to say, here's the point. You got a problem with that with a tunnel. You're going to look that out.
Right. Well, let's break here. I actually need to get off campus to a meeting, and so this is a good break point.